respond to you for a while. And in one particular case, my particular converter box, I had to literally turn it off. Thank goodness it didn't lose any of its memory of what channels I had found. It's got some kind of permanent memory for that. But I had to reset it, so to speak, before it would respond to commands. So there are certain command combinations, or if you hit them too fast, it'll sit there and say, no, I ain't going to do nothing over to you, Raphael. And it's going to be a little bit tough because you're trying to maintain a whole lot of people in your neighborhood. I know what's going on. K2KEY, K2LIW. Hang in there.
Okay, Roger. Well, okay, let's talk about a couple questions that some people asked about. First of all, I got the Zenith 901. Now, you say how many channels actually, when it says 37, are we looking at? Because some of them, like you say, are grouped together. How are you going to know that unless you go through them one by one and count them? Because it just tells you after it scans through, found. It says found and a number. How many channels? It doesn't tell you, like you said, if it's for one, for two, for whatever it is, it's counted as one channel. No, it don't. It counts, I guess, each one of those as a notch. And so that the end result is how many are found. Now, somebody said also about, you know, that the picture is, well, the vertical, you can see it's squeezed down on the digital channels, the HD channels. On the Zenith 901 box, they got a thing that says zoom. If I'm pushing this right now, zoom, it comes through after you push it about three times, it says crop, C-R-O-P-P, crop, C-R-O-P-P-E-D. And the picture now goes to full screen, Dick, over.
Yeah, when I go to display mode on the digital box, digital converter from Radio Shack, bought about a month ago, in the display mode, depending on what channel you're on, you've got about five choices for display. One of them is called zoom, one of them is called 16 by 9, one of them is called 14 by 9, one of them is called, I think, something like crop, and another one is called axiomatic or something like that. I got a whole bunch of choices on some of the channels. Some of the channels, it doesn't give you any choices. I noticed that on ABC 7, I've got about five choices as to how I display it. And I'm a little bit amazed that when I go to the 16 by 9 on a so-called high-def transmission, sometimes it fills up the screen horizontally, and I get letterboxes on top and bottom. Sometimes it does not fill up the screen horizontally. So there's various modes of display. There's various modes of transmission. Let's pass it over to Eric if he's got a couple of words on that one before we go back to Mel. KE2EJ, K2LIW.
K2LIW, K2EJ. Now you're getting into stuff called pillar box, postage stamp. That's what happens when you take a 16 by 9 program that, let's say, high def, 16 by 9, you're now going to put it on a channel that's 4 by 3, and what do? You make a letterbox out of it. Well, what if that 4 by 3 station that you happen to be transmitting on is transmitting it at HD? So a lot of people will take the standard definition and upconvert it for their HD channel, and what they wind up with is a letterbox within a 16 by 9, and the picture gets very small. And it doesn't even make it out to the edges. Normally you'll see on an HD channel, if you happen to have an HD set that's 16 by 9, it will fill it out to 16 by 9. With a converter box, if you're looking at an HD channel, you will tell the converter box that you have a 4 by 3 set, and what it will do is it will automatically make letterbox for you. But if it happens to be a letterbox program that's being sent within an HD channel that started off being a standard 4x3, you get a very tiny picture.
On top of that, there are modes you can set it on certain channels where everybody looks skinny and tall. So I think it's one of the zoom modes. There's going to be a learning curve here, Mel, as I see it.
There's actually an answer coming to this one.
Go right ahead.
The networks are beginning to use it. PBS is using it now. We just finished experimenting with it. Called AFD. What is it? Aspect ratio format descriptor. And with each type of content in its metadata, and its metadata is a little database that's associated with a file, because most people don't realize that the stuff that they're seeing is coming off of a hard drive somewhere. There's a bit of metadata that's contained with the file that says what format this is. So if they happen to be, like in the case of PBS, we do distribute a lot of standard definition stuff. A lot of the sub-channels you'll see when there's an HD channel will be sub-channels of the standard definition. It's not an easy task to put two HD channels on one channel. You can. There aren't that many people that do it because there's some inherent problems because of the limitation in bandwidth. But I'm going to drop the... Networks are also having the distribution channels for HD and SD. So, the automatic format descriptor, when there's a 16x9 standard definition program, and remember there can be 16x9 525, there's also 16x9 1080, there's also 16x9 720. So, what that means is, if you were to look at a 16x9 525 on a regular 4x3 monitor, everybody looks tall and skinny. It actually has to play on a 16x9 monitor for them to look correct in height and width. So we send this little descriptor along, which tells the receiver in the end, the receiver that you have right now actually can understand it, but it's not being activated just yet. It will adjust the format on your TV set to work with whatever the format is that's coming down, so you don't get postage stamp type pictures or skinny people, or it only doesn't make it out to the edge of your TV screen. K2RW, KE2ZI.
But I can get my question answered. It's K2KEY.
Why don't you ask it right now? We're slowly learning, though. Go ahead, Mel.
Okay, you and I want to compare right now, Dick. How many channels are we getting? I see it says found 37. However, we just decided that like 4-1, 4-2, and all that is going to be counted as one channel. So how do we determine this? What, do we have to actually go channel by channel and write down on the paper, oh, we got two on two, and four has got three, and five has got two, and so on and so forth? I mean, how do we compare? Because it doesn't tell you, it just tells you a summation. Of like here, found, I'm just looking, found 37 channels, Dick. So how do we make a comparison if I've got a Venus box and you have, a Radio Shack box, over?
In the case of my Radio Shack box, one of the many menus I can go to, and it's got a very thick instruction manual that comes with it, and I've only read 10% of it, one of the manuals I can go to allows me to see what I would call a spreadsheet. The spreadsheet has, on the left-hand column, the channel number that's popularly known.
It's called an EPG, Electronic Program Guide.
Give that man a cigar, the EPG. Go to the Electronic Programming Guide, and I can see them all displayed. Oh, I guess there's about eight of them vertically, and it's a spreadsheet. Horizontally, the spreadsheet has got about six columns to it. The left-hand column is the popular channel number. The next column is the real RF channel number. I think the next channel number, the next vertical column, I think, is the network affiliation. And I think after that, some little descriptor. And you'll see a 2, a 4-1, 4-2, 4-3, 5-1, 5-2, 5-3, and so on. All I've got to do is count the main number. So in the three examples I just gave you, I've got a channel 2, I've got a channel 4, and I've got a channel 5. The number of the dash numbers doesn't matter. And you can vertically scroll through these pages of this EPG. So once you get to the right menu, and I think almost all of them have something equivalent to that particular menu, it'll be pretty easy for you to find out how many what I call true channel numbers. And even if you don't do that, just by pressing the up button on your remote display, in 60 seconds, I'll take it back, in 120 seconds, you'll know how many channels you got. You'll have to write down the 2, the 4, the 5, the 7, the 9, the 11, the 13, and so on. It's not that many. And that way, I think we got a better method of comparison, because other than that, the total number of dash numbers, the sub-channels, are continuously going to be changing. Therefore, it's kind of hard to keep track of what's really going on RF-wise. You and I are RF persons, Mel, and we want to know how many true RF channels are we
receiving. That's my guess. K2KEY, KQRIW.
KC2QIQ.
Glenn recognized, but Mel first.
Okay, this says K2KEY. Well, I'm doing it while you're talking. I went to the menu, and in the menu on the Zenith box, they do not give you that option that you just said, unless something I've missed here. But I don't see that. So the only way I could do, actually, is, like you say, is bring up that bar and go through and say, well, let's see, right now, let's say if I was to bring up, let me see how to do this, bring up guide. It has a button guide here, and it says 13. I'm looking at Eric's channel right now. It says 13.1, 13.2, 13.3. We'll count that, I guess, is that correct, then? We're going to count that as one channel, over.
Roger, Roger. That's one channel. Glenn, I bet you solved this problem. And by the way, you now get channel 13, I hope. KC2QIQ, K2RIW.
No, unfortunately, I don't, Dick. I still have to have a prior VHF antenna added to my little array up there. But I have a slightly different question. I was wondering if anybody had noticed. I know, like, if you're looking for programming information on what's going on each channel, NBC, ABC, CBS, there's going to be a listing, I guess, in the newspaper. But I was wondering about the subchannels. Has anybody noticed, is there a listing for what's going to be broadcast on those on the subchannels, like if you open up a newspaper or a TV guide for it somewhere? KC2QIQ.
Okay, you
want
an answer?
Boy, do we want an answer. You got it, Eric.
Right now, okay, there's something called Tribune News Service. They basically, all the stations send their schedules to Tribune about a month before. They, in turn, distribute it to newspapers, magazines, TV guides, and other forms of outlets, right? Also, the cable systems. The cable systems don't really concern themselves, because if you like on Cablevision, we talk about Channel 21, there's a listing for 21, there's a listing for Create, and there's a listing for World, but they're handled as individual channels in there. Their scrolling guide, but within the next 3 to 6 months, you'll begin to see sub-channels show up in the listings. But currently, the best way to do it is to go to the individual station website, and it'll tell you what's on what.
Interesting. Not only that, but I've noticed that once you dial in a particular channel, there is a program guide, something like the EBG, EPG, but it's a little bit different. It's a kind of a program guide you can go to when you're dialed into that channel, which will tell you what's going to happen for the next 24 hours. It'll tell you each one of the programs, stop time, name of the program, and maybe a couple of words as to what it is. So on my particular box, I can go to that channel, and that channel will tell me what they tend to broadcast for the next 24 hours. Maybe you want to go give that a try in one of your submenus there, Mel. K2KEY, K2RIW.
I tried that. I don't see anything. Let's see. I go into Guide. Let's take, for instance, Guide. Let's see. It says now. I'm looking at 13, let's say, 3. It says, it tells you new and next. What the heck is that? I guess the new is what, from 9 to 10:30, and then it's next, then it says Rock Band, 10:30 to 11. Is that what you're talking about, Dick? Over.
Yes, I am. When I go to menu on my particular remote control of my particular box, it then opens up a screen where I've got 5 menus I can choose from on the left-hand vertical column. Each of them have about 5 more sub-menus. Each one of them has a number of menus. So I got menus of menus of menus. And one of those functions I can go to, a particular channel I'm tuned to, will tell me essentially what's going to happen for most of the next 24 hours. By way of your next and now, I think you're finding out at least what is currently playing and what's the very next thing going to be playing. But I'll bet you if you study your instruction manual for your particular box, I'll bet you there is a menu there where you can look even further into the future, Ramil. K2KEY, K2RIW.
W-A-2-M-A-Z.
M-A-Z, recognized. I'm going to get to you in a second. Go ahead, Mel.
Oh, I did not see that. I read the instructions pretty careful, and I did not. I'm looking at the menu now, and you can go into the different aspects that the menu offers. You know, they got the, clicked again, aspect set by program, TV ratio, things like that, and all. Then it says lock system, password systems, and all. But I don't see any, oh, they got a movie rating system, if that means anything. Dick, over.
Nope, not the rating system I'm talking about. It sounded like M-A-Z, W-A-2-M-A-Z, but I think I've got that wrong. Correct me, and then tell me your name, and proceed with your question, sir.
W-A-2-Mike-Alpha-Victor. Not a question, it's a comment. Some of the boxes don't have the expanded EPG. The Radio Shack 99, 199.50, when you're on each channel, would have the expanded one, but I think the Zenith might just be limited. You can go on the internet and you can see which boxes have the better programming guide. Over.
Good information, Mark, and thank you. Okay, so maybe you don't have it. I'm amazed that the inexpensive Radio Shack box seems to have so darn many capabilities. How I was chose the Radio Shack box is two things. One, Eric was telling me who's doing pretty good in all the brand names you can buy. And second of all, there's a guy I work with who in the last couple of months has supposedly gone through five separate converter boxes. And from reason after reason, he was extremely displeased with the first four boxes he bought, converter boxes, digital converter boxes, and he sold them all on eBay. His fifth box he got a hold of was the Radio Shack one. He says, aha, I have arrived. It is the most sensitive, it is the most tolerant of, in his opinion, most tolerant of multipath, and gave him menus with enough capability to keep him happy. So that's sort of how I chose that particular brand, and it's one of the less expensive ones. I think there's a couple of other people trying to sign in and tell us information. As you can tell, the main subject of information, the main subject of discussion tonight in the technical net seems to be digital television. We will discuss a couple of real ham radio subjects. Hang in there if you're able to stay up late enough. But right now, this is the hot subject because we're all going through the learning curve with these new chunks of electronics. And boy, have I got a lot more channels than I do. A lot of channels coming into my house, but they were not getting to the set because of some dumb things that I did, which I'll tell you guys about later. Anyone else out there want to contribute to all this? Give me a call. That is right now. KGRIW in the TechNet.
This is KC2QIW, mobile and listening.
Mr. QIW, mobile. Start off with your name and anything you want to add or ask. Your choice, sir.
Hey, my name here is Joe. I'm in the mobile, KC2QIW, out here in Westchester County, from Maroney, New York. No questions. I'm just supporting the net and just listening for now. And back to the net.
Okay.
I'll be back in a second, Big.
Roger, Dodger. Mr. QIW, KC2QIW, if I got it right, did you once live in Seaford?
Last time I checked, negative, no. I grew up in Harrison, New York, over here in Westchester County.
Okay, do I have your call letters correctly? Kilowatt Charlie 2, Quebec, India, Whiskey. Over to you.
No, change that I to a Y. It's KC2QYW, Quebec Yankee Whiskey. Yeah, it's a tongue tie, you know, everybody gets that Y mixed up with the I.
Okay, now we got you, Joel. Parsons Street, Harrison, New York. And you're real. I was a little worried there. Very good. Glad you joined us. As you can tell, we're having a lot of discussions on digital television. Let's see now. I know Joe is one guy in the wings here waiting. Let's see, who else have we got who gave us a yes? I think it's only Joe so far. Other than Joe, the H-U-R-Y way, is there anyone else who gave me a yes when they signed in saying they do have a question?
KB2GXM, I'm back at the base now for, I guess, later on.
Very fine, Gary. Okay. And a little bit of hissing there, but you're doing quite well. Anything you want to ask or add, Mel, before we go back to slightly more ham radio subjects. K2KEY, K2RIW.
Okay, no, I'm just going through it. That's the difference. I guess the Radio Shack box and the Zenith box are somewhat different, Dick. I did try a one place, they did try the, they also did the same experiment, you know, trying different boxes. And for some reason, the Zenith box is working, and the Radio Shack box is not working. There you are. Go figure that one out. You found maybe the opposite, over.
Well, I'm only going by the testimony of the guy I work with. I myself have only bought one box. I take it back. I did get a box of older design from Kent, and I, at the time, had a very poor antenna, hooked it up, and didn't get any response. I guess I should try that one again just to see what it does do. So I'm down to my last two converter boxes. The real dumb thing that I did for the last year, I had remembered that the UHF antenna at my QTH is a 5-foot diameter dish at the 70-foot level of my radio tower. That was my UHF antenna. The antenna on the roof of the house is the VHF antenna, which happens to have UHF capability. So therefore, if I use a simple power splitter to put those two antennas together into the set, I would have UHF coming from two sources simultaneously. They'd be beating against each other with two different cable lengths. So I went and bought one of these crazy splitters that has frequency selective capability. I bought a splitter that has a two input, one output, where one input favors VHF channels and one input favors UHF channels. It hooked up the appropriate antennas. Well, the UHF antenna on the tower failed, no longer there, just an empty piece of cable, and I was still getting a couple of the stronger UHF channels. I assumed that they were being picked up by that cable. They were sneaking through the VHF pass on the frequency selective power divider, summer, from the rooftop antenna. I didn't realize that. I was about to go up to my rooftop antenna and temporarily put up a combination antenna, VHF-UHF. Suddenly realized that antenna already had UHF. I got rid of the frequency selective power divider, and all of a sudden a zillion UHF channels that I've never seen before came through, like almost every one of them. So for the last year, I've had a bunch of UHF signals coming into the house, but they couldn't get past that darn frequency selective power divider. So I outfoxed myself in lousy memory. Now when I put a real UHF antenna on top of the tower with a rotator, I got to have an awful lot of fun with television DXing some of the stuff that Joe has been doing. I'm going to stand by, see if there's anyone else with any questions or comments on
repeater. Time out.
I'm going to stand by to see if there's any questions or comments on what we've discussed so far. If not, then we'll go over to Joe's question. Oh, wait a minute now. This is JXN. Sorry about that. And I think Joe came before JXN. Yes, he did. So we've got to go to Joe first. Let me let the machine drop all the way for a few seconds just to make sure we're not losing anyone else who wants to sign in by one of the out-of-area techniques like VOIP and Echo Link and whatever. So we're going to stand by and see if there's anyone else there. K2RIW TechNet.
WO2N. WO2N checking.
Whiskey 02N. Okay. Out of curiosity, you do have a question or a comment, or are you just letting us know that you're there?
It's Whiskey Oscar, Dick. Name is Bernie. I know I had a query on the digital television.
Go right ahead with your digital television question, Bernie.
Okay, not at all. The fanfare is in with the digital television. I wonder if the power stations are going to be doing anything to improve the signal out over Long Island, because for years the UHF signal seemed to drop off right at Patchogue. So for the hundreds of thousands east of Patchogue, we were never fortunate to really watch TV from New York City. Now I wonder if they're going to improve the signal where they can blanket Long Island, where a normal outside antenna on a normal setup, we'll be able to watch TV and not be sort of hostages to the cable company out here. WO2N.
Yeah, I got some yeses and no answers to your question, Bernie. Bernie lives in Mastic, and he's predicting that the UHF channels get out as far as Patchogue, but nowhere near out as far as Mastic, about 10 miles further out. I'm guessing you're about 50 or 60 miles east of New York City as the crow flies, Bernie. And here I am in Huntington. 300 feet above sea level is the land that I carefully bought. Although I've got heavily wooded trees, I've got a medium fringe area antenna on the chimney of the house. And some of the UHF channels, like channel 33 UHF real RF frequency, which turns out to be channel 2 CBS broadcast, does not come through with sufficient strength and clarity into my house, 33 miles east of Empire State Building. If I can't get it, you ain't going to get it for sure. Now, Eric did tell us a couple of things around the way that are going to help. Number one, many of the broadcast centers on the UHF digital television that they're transmitting right now are using their backup antenna, their fill antenna, the things that are on the side of the Empire State Building as the contingency antennas, I'm going to call them. And that in the coming months, the majority of those antennas will be mounted on the high spot of the Empire State Building. That's number one that's going to help. Better antenna, higher location. Number two, a number of the broadcast centers are going to go to the so-called enhanced mode in the next couple of months, where they're going to be transmitting a greater amount of power. That's the good news. However, I'm going to sit here and make a couple of guesses, Bernie. Let me drop. And maybe Eric will correct me on this. And that is, my guesses are that with the antenna going higher in the Empire State Building, that's a small percentage of increase in true altitude. The antenna is being better designed and a little bit higher in gain. That's going to give you a couple of dB. Altogether, you're going to get, I'm going to pick a number out of the air, 5, 6 dB more signal on UHF channels. Is that enough for you to do it out in Mastic? I think the answer is no. If you're willing to put up a radio tower, and as a ham radio operator, the answer is you certainly are. If you're willing to put up a ham radio tower with enough altitude to clear your local trees, I know that when I had my UHF antenna at the 70-foot level of my radio tower, and I've got 80-foot trees here, the number of UHF channels I got when I did this experiment way back in the 70s was huge. I was watching UHF television from, on a summer day, Maryland, Delaware, Pennsylvania, New Jersey, southern New York State, Connecticut, occasionally Rhode Island, occasionally into Massachusetts. I was watching UHF television from all of those areas. Once my UHF antenna cleared the trees on my somewhat high land by Long Island standards. So I think you stand a good chance if you're willing to put the antenna high enough to clear your local terrain. But if your antenna is on the chimney of the house, and if the trees in Mastic are anything like the trees in Huntington, I think you're not going to get great reception on a number of those UHF channels unless the antenna itself is pretty heroic. I think altitude is going to give you 90% of the benefit, and then buying a super-duper antenna like a 5 or a 7-foot diameter UHF dish could help. I know, maybe your philosophy is a little bit like mine, Bernie. I have never paid for television. I'm a cheap guy. I have never owned cable TV.
Hey, Dick?
Yeah, go ahead.
The one thing that's going to make a difference is when they do go to the antenna stack, the proper antenna stack, we're not talking about signal strength here. We're talking about the ability to pull bits out of the air, so the improvement is going to be like night and day, because when they do turn off that backfill antenna, everybody's receiver all of a sudden starts working.
Okay, but you being a broadcast engineer can maybe make a guess. Even with all of those improvements, will his UHF channel on most of those UHF frequencies get all the way out to Mastic? That's a haul by my standards. I think he's in the grade C area, so to speak. What's your guess on that one, Eric?
All right, well, you know, foliage doesn't do nice things to UHF. But if you've got a signal that's not messed up to start with, Well, the digital can be very forgiving and do better than the analog in that respect. You can have less RF and still have a nice, solid, clean picture. But the reality is I have a friend in Smithtown who's got an antenna a little bit above the top of his house. It comes to hide in summer. The trees are definitely in front of the antenna, so, you know, it has its effect. But when the backfill antenna is turned off, it gets everything really nice. When the backfill antenna is turned on, like it normally is, you can't get... he gets all the VHF now great. The VHF, you know, he's getting 13, 11, and 7. He's never gotten, you know, high signal strength on it. The VHF works very well. But when the backfill antenna is on, he can't get 33 and 28.
Okay, so I'm going to make a guess, Bernie. If you're willing to put the antenna tall enough, I think on most days in Mastic, when all these improvements take place, you're going to get most of those channels, is my belief. But you're going to be putting up a television receiving antenna at considerably higher than normal altitude for your particular community. But being a ham radio operator who loves VHF and you want your antennas up high, you've got a triple motivation for doing it, as I see it, Bernie. W0WO2N, KQRIW.
All right, very interesting. Give me some food for thought. I did have up a 13-element VHF monobander with on a rotator, on a mast, on the roof, maybe 30 feet high, with a preamp on it, and then I brought it to cable down inside and put a preamp, another preamp on there, and it was a crapshoot. Marginal signal, 7 was better than 2 and 4, but it was a compromise. It was a compromise, watchable, but not always predictable, especially on days where two, you know, we'd have a little sunspot action going on. But, you know, it just, it was a sacrifice to sit there and watch it. Sometimes it was punishing. I could probably turn north and to Hartford, 70 miles north, and get a better signal than I could out of NBC off Empire on Sundays, for instance. I could get a 70-mile signal going across the sound better, and then I would receive direct trying to go through Suffolk County, Nassau County, and into Manhattan. But from what they were saying about the digital being a little weak, less power now, I figure I even go through the effort. I could get it up on top of the tower and maybe worth giving it a shot, you know, at maybe 50 feet up. A big monoband. I have to get a fringe, and I had a fringe antenna up there, fringe area antenna, which was rated at 95 miles. And it was still a marginal signal, like I said, with the preamp on there. I went through it, and I did everything I could to improve it. It was watchable, but still wasn't great. But I thought maybe the digital or the broadcast companies, you know, have to put out, as public service, at least could blanket Long Island with a beam type or repeat type of signal so that all of Long Island would be able to get signals from the high-powered company. But I guess maybe they don't have to reach the fringe areas. WO2N.
I think they want to reach the fringe areas, Bernie. It's a matter of economics. Yes, the true amount of power being transmitted by the new digital television transmitters is slightly lower. However, the nature of the converter box is it can tolerate a hell of a lot weaker signal than analog could, with reference to analog getting a, you know, full snow-free picture. And it's even ahead of the game when it comes to a snowy picture on analog. So there's a couple of pluses and a couple of minuses. The fact that most of the channels are UHF is what's going to hurt. You're going to get a beautiful signal with that antenna on a tower for channels 7, 11, and 13. They're both using the real VHF upper frequencies, which propagate a lot nicer. If you're willing to put up a dish, I think the highest gain UHF antenna you can put up By the way, it's only 2.4 kilowatts. The 2.4 kilowatts is the digital transmission for channel 21 or channel 13, Eric?
13.
13 is 2.4 kilowatts. Is it going to stay 2.4 or is it going to later go up to an enhanced mode?
I think they get an ERP of something around 90 kilowatts or something like that. I don't remember what they gave the antenna is, but that's it. They ain't getting any louder than that.
Okay, that's channel 13. What do you think for the other networks? Are any of those going to go to higher power at a later time? I thought LIW was considering going to a higher power at a later time.
Well, a lot of people put in for maximization. It's not an easy task, so... you know, if it does come up, it will. And a lot of people are being rejected because of cartel interference.
Okay, so it takes an FCC proposal to go to what I call enhanced mode. I forget what word you used for it, but it has a similar meaning. And what's the word you used? Maximization?
Yeah, that's what they call it, maximization. Maximization of your coverage area. Langley way.
Okay. What's the rough approximation as to the number of miles of separation between co-channels that the FCC will approve? I know it's very terrain dependent and a whole lot of other things, but what's the rough approximate number of miles?
There's no, like, average. I mean, there is an average if people actually sit down and calculate it. It really all depends upon a lot of factors. But the Langley predictions are what the terrain is, what the actual operating power for whatever the grade B size audience is. There's also media overlap that has to be taken into consideration. You know, it can be as close as 60 miles and as far away as like 200 or 300. It depends where you are in the country, too.
Yeah, some of what you saw, Bernie, where you would aim your antenna to the north when it was on the tower, and you would get a beautiful signal from Hartford. Because the Long Island Sound is such a beautiful medium for transmitting a signal for about two or three reasons. One, it doesn't have trees, nice and smooth, gives you a clean reflection, and it's got high humidity air above it. That gives you the super refraction phenomenon. The guys on 10 gigahertz in the beginning used to believe that they would only be able to transmit line-of-sight signals 30, 40 miles. I personally have made a contact using a 0.2 watt of 10 gigs on single sideband. I talked to a guy 340 miles away at Cape Hatteras, North Carolina, by what's called super refraction. In the case of the 10 gig band, if you live within 200 miles of a major body of water like the Atlantic Ocean, you get a band opening some portion of every single 24-hour day. And it usually lasts for a few hours. And that's the super refraction phenomenon. That's where the wave senses the fact that there's higher humidity down low in altitude compared to up high where it's drier. High humidity air has got a higher dielectric constant. The wave travels a little bit slower there. And it bends the wave downward. And when that wave gets bent downward and follows Earth's curvature, that guy 380 miles away sounds like he's in your backyard. That signal was 25 dB out of my noise. And so... you're getting the benefit of that when you aim to the north over the Long Island Sound. So having a, for us on Long Island, who are very far east of the Empire State Building, and you gotta go through all that Earth curvature and trees and everything else. By the way, you calculate the amount of Earth curvature between Mastic and the Empire State Building. And even though the Empire State Building is 1,300 feet high, you're not line of sight at the Empire State Building because of Earth curvature. It's a lot more than you think. So there's a hell of a blockage there. And you don't get as much super refraction when you drop them over the kind of terrain of Long Island, and you're going down the length of Long Island as opposed to going across the pond, the Long Island Sound, going up to Connecticut. So there's great benefit, as I see it, Bernie, in you and I setting up a tower-mounted, significant-gain UHF antenna with rotator, because you're going to see a whole lot of digital television signals that you can get from Rhode Island and Connecticut and occasionally Massachusetts, as well as occasionally southern New Jersey and Empire State Building. So if you want to do some serious television watching, and if you're cheap as I am, and Mel's also a conservative guy, he doesn't pay for television. I don't pay for television. I'd much rather install the hardware and experiment with it. That's what Joe does also. So back to you, Bernie, for any other comments. And you got enough buddies that'll help you. You got enough buddies that'll help you mount that antenna. Who just signed in?
I just gained $8 a day and to an anyhow.
Receiving.
Okay, I heard Alex and somebody else. Who was the other person?
Hey, you got Gary over here, KB2JXM.
Okay, Gary, we'll get to you in a minute. You're next on the list right after we finish with Bernie. Go ahead for any other comments, Bernie.
Okay, let's say we choose to have that option of watching free television. We grew up in that era where television was free, the airwaves were free. And now, I guess it's a choice to live out away from the signal and then have to pay for something that, you know, they're getting for free. We're paying for it again. But it's food for thought, and if I can find a nice, fringe range antenna that's going to work with good digital signals, that might be worthwhile. Have the sun climb up there and put it on a 10-foot pipe and be on the rotator, and they will do a little television watching back that way and not be hostage to the cable company and their boxes, I guess, that only work with the cable. That's another thing. These cable boxes won't work with the cable company. I think that's a whole other scrambled signal that requires their box, I understand, which are like $6 a month each box when you have to pay for them. So it can be, you know, quite expensive when a lot of people have three or four sets. You're paying $25, $30 a month just for the box, not even the service. So it's going to be very expensive. Last time, WO2N. And thanks for the info. Enjoyed it. Back to Ned.
Yeah, keep us informed as you select a real good modern UHF high-gain antenna and mount it at a high location, hopefully on your radio tower. And television DXing is a fun thing to do. Gary, KB2JXN, go right ahead with your cable length question, K2RIW on the TechNet.
You're talking about Gary, Rand, because I have the volume down a little bit.
I'm talking to Mr. JXN. Is that guy named Gary?
It's a distinct possibility.
Fire when ready, Gary.
Okay. I just want to make sure that we're hitting the repeater okay, because I'm on medium-low power. You need some more power there, or are we good enough?
You're good enough. You sound, you're 95% quieting.
Okay, very good. All right, we discussed this once before, maybe half a year ago, maybe about a year ago. A friend of mine gave me an antenna. It's a Comet GP15, and it was working okay. It's a tri-bander. It's for 6 meters, 2 meters, 440. After a couple of months, I noticed that on 2 meters, I was getting a lot of intermittent SWR, erratic SWR readings. I made sure that the antenna was, all the connections, coax, PL259s, all that stuff was okay. Tried another coax, and still I have this problem. So last year, during vacation, I took it up in the woods there, up at the cabin, and figured, well, I got some time now, I can go work on this. So I found an exploded capacitor, probably in one of the traps. You have to, it's one of these antennas that's encased in a fiberglass barrel. You take one set screw out, the whole thing comes out. It's got all these, I guess about 7 capacitors. I got a schematic for this thing, but it was in Japanese. I couldn't read most of it. I just got number values, so the number values did not match up what's on the schematic. So what I have to do is try different values of capacitance. And I'm getting close to it. The one capacitor exploded probably because it was on the, maybe on the current high side. I was only putting about 45 watts into it max, because that's all this radio will do. And the antenna itself is rated for 150, so it might have been the current high at that right, at that spot where the capacitor was. So yeah, it exploded. I got a picture of it. So I'm trying new values, but as I'm trying it, I'm putting this, I mounted the antenna on my deck on a mast, and I have three different lengths of coax, and I'm trying them all different, you know, the three different lengths, and I'm getting all three different SWRs. So I think the final word on that was just pick a length, any length. Don't worry about the SWR because you're going to get some reflection. You're going to get more reflection with the shorter coax. And that was just about the total bottom line of that whole thing. I don't know if you remember that or not.
Yes, I do. And once you properly calculate the insertion loss of the cable when you go from a shorter cable to a longer cable, and you crank that loss back out, and therefore correct the measurement you made in the shack of standing wave ratio, if your cable is not hot with RF on the outside, then you should keep coming back to the exact same standing wave ratio regardless of cable length. I probably asked you this question, I'll insult you a little bit to repeat it, I'm not sure if I did or not. Is there any chance of going back to the manufacturer and either buying that capacitor or finding out what it was? Bernie, go ahead. Sorry, Gary.
Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, I meant Gary. Can you go back to the manufacturer of that antenna, I think you called it a GP15, and find out what that capacitor was, either buy that capacitor from him or at least find out its value?
That means I have to go back to Japan. There's nothing around here except distributors who sell it, and Probably 99% of them do not have anything of schematics or anything like that. I did write an email to this one guy of Comet, I guess it was Comet Service Center, and he sent me a schematic, but again, it was in Japanese, except for the number values. But the schematic, the values of all seven capacitors are close, but do not match what I actually have in the antenna itself. So that's where I have to start guessing and, you know, plugging in different values. The one capacitor that exploded, I think it's 18 picofarads. So I'm trying a 15, a 17, a 20, and, you know, measuring the SWRs upon all three bands, I'm getting close. The capacitor that I'm using right now are a little bigger. They actually do fit in when I have to assemble the whole antenna again. They actually do fit in there, so a bigger capacitor is the way to go. What was in there before was just a little 100-volt disc capacitor, so yeah, that exploded probably on current high.
Why don't you use a variable capacitor just to find out the proper value and then replace it with a fixed one and do it anyway?
Good suggestion, Alex, but I think I'm going to make a guess. This capacitor is inside of a tube that has to be assembled with fiberglass insulation. There may not be room in there to put a air variable transmitting grade capacitor. I'm just making a guess. See what Gary's got to say about that. KB2JXN, K2RIW.
Hey, you can extend the 1-inch, 2-inch of wire and take that into account.
Okay, maybe he can mount it on the outside and with a fat piece of wire, feed it through a hole, make it act like it's on the inside, and get the same performance. That's possibly doable. And at first, you just want to find out what value capacitor gives you the right performance. Weatherproofing it and how you physically mount it is something you can do later. So I think Alex has got a possible approach there, Gary. KB2JXN, K2RIW.
Okay, I believe Alex said to put a variable air capacitor in. I couldn't make half of that out. Okay, so just in case that's what he said, no, there's no room for that unless it's a real small trimmer cap. I do not have a capacitor meter, so that's why I'm stuck, you know, soldering, trying out different caps.
Is there any way you can drill a small hole and bring out a one or two wires that represent the location of the capacitor that's inside? And what Alex is saying is that if you put either the capacitor on the outside or an air variable capacitor on the outside, and if you have to add a couple of inches of wire in order to put it on the outside of the antenna, antenna tuning-wise, a couple of inches is an extremely small fraction of a wavelength. although it may be homely looking for the test, electronically you can make it work almost identical to the real capacitor on the inside. So there's a way you can drill a hole, bring out a shielded lead with spaghetti to make sure it doesn't short to the metal, and put a capacitor on the outside to find out what it needs, and then weatherproofing this and putting the right capacitor inside after you find it is the next step. So do you think that's a possibility, Gary? Over to you, Gary.
Well, yeah, it is a possibility, although, yes, I can drill a hole or two small holes in the fiberglass, because the barrel itself is fiberglass, so there's no spaghetti needed for doing something like that. The only thing I don't like, even though you and I both know the wavelength is too small for any big kind of a change like that, but I'm just worried about the inductance for long leads like that.
Well, a trick of the old people.
What is the trick of the old people, Alex? Go ahead. And I'll interpret for him. Go ahead, Alex.
Make your own capacitor of two twisted wire. So you take two isolated wire, you twist them tightly, solder them in the place of your connector, and now you start snipping at them until you get the proper capacitance.
Okay. I'll interpret the Romanian for you. I'm having fun with Alex. Yeah, he's right. When you take two wires and twist them, you can change the value of the capacitance by how tight you twist them, how long they are, and by snipping it and whatever. There's all kinds of ways you can make what's called a gimmick capacitor by twisting wires together. And at the transmitting level where you want to operate, well, you can do the test at the 5-watt or the 10-watt level. It doesn't have to be at the 100-watt level. To make a gimmick capacitor tolerate 100 watts, that's another issue. Right now you want to find out how many picofarads. And even though you don't have a capacitance measuring meter, it's a very interesting science experiment, Gary, to measure capacitance of small capacitors. If you have a high impedance voltmeter, AC voltmeter, it can be a digital voltmeter, it can be a vacuum tube voltmeter. When you have a high impedance meter, and these high impedance meters usually are 10 megohms of input impedance. When you take a 6.3 volt filament transformer, ground one lead, take the other lead, put it in series with the capacitor, then put it into the 10 megohm meter and measure the AC voltage at 60 cycles that comes through your capacitor. You've really got a CR network. Not too difficult to calculate that. And within 5% accuracy, you can measure the capacitance down to 1 picofarad with 60 cycles into the capacitor, into a 10 megohm AC voltmeter. I've done it. In fact, there used to be an article, let me drop. There used to be an article in Electronics Magazine. A Popular Electronics. There was an article in Popular Electronics way back in the dark ages of 1960-something. And I still have the chart from that article taped to the side of my Heathkit vacuum tube voltmeter. And it tells you what scale, what voltage you read, how many picofarads. And what they're doing is taking the 6.3 volt filament winding that's inside the meter and bringing out an extra lead that puts it through a capacitor. So measuring small capacitors is no, it's not rocket science. You'd be amazed how easy it is to do. You know how to calculate capacitive reactance. Make believe it's ohms. And that's your source impedance. And the 10 megohms of the voltmeter, of the AC voltmeter, electronic voltmeter, is the load resistance. And therefore, what voltage you read, which really is current that flows through the capacitor, tells you exactly how many picofarads you got with about 5% accuracy. So I know you have the ability, with a little bit of a science philosophy here, to measure small picofarads by way of real air variables that you put on the outside, by way of leads and you drill holes through the fiberglass, or by making a gimmick capacitor just to run the test at low power by twisting wires together. That's what Alex is suggesting here. You will find a solution to this one, even though you no longer have access to the original capacitor there, Gary. Hang in there. I think you're going to find a solution. KB2JXN, K2RIW.
Yeah, I knew you were going to come up with something like that. I've done the gimmick before. I first saw that in Lafayette Comstat 25A CB back in the 60s. They did the same thing. They twisted two pairs together. And people were coming to me, please modify my radio for me. So all I had to do was twist these two together, and they thought their output was 10 watts, and all I did was change the RF meter, you know. Oh, I'm doing 10 watts now. Sure, you're doing 10 watts. All right, well, I haven't changed the wattage at all. let's see here. I can try the two-wire gimmick thing again. I haven't done it on this antenna, but yeah, I could try that. Probably even leave it like that. I don't think. Hopefully, the insulation is not going to heat up and do a number. But I do have small capacitors that I was trying one by one, and really, I don't mind doing that either. The only problem is I don't have many of them, so I might have to revert back to the two-wire gimmick thing.
Yeah, either with the air variables that you own or the two-wire gimmick thing, with the two wires coming out of the fiberglass, you eventually find the capacitor that makes the antenna happy. Once you find that, you've got a couple of choices then. Either you put a plastic box around the gimmick capacitor and weatherproof it, coat it with coil dope or elastic adhesive or something. That's one approach. Coating it with elastic adhesive is going to change the capacitor. Be careful on that one. The other approach is you now have the ability with the digital voltmeter of measuring the picofarads. Therefore, you'll know how many picofarads you need. That tells you what combination of series and parallel capacitors of the ones you've got will get you there, or it tells you how to go to the catalog and buy that many picofarads from the catalog, if you know what I mean. So step by step, I'm pretty sure you can find a solution by this procedure. And even if it doesn't work, you can come back and keep asking us the question. And this group has got enough brain power. We'll eventually find a way to get that thing to fly, Gary. KB2JXN, K2LAW.
Thanks a lot, you guys. No problem. But the thing is flying already. I got the thing going. I'm just really close. I'm close with the SWR. I'm going by SWR. I have an 18 picofarad in there right now. And let's see, the schematic, it's been a year now. There's, let's see, 1.5, the schematic said 1, then there's a 3. Well, I'm not going to go through it again. Yeah, there was two 27s at the end, I remember that. The one, let's see, there was two, the one, yeah, the two that they were same, two that were the same, one of them exploded. I think they were 18s. So, I had a pretty good SWR now, so I think it's below 1.5, maybe even 1.6, you know, across three bands. So that's not too bad right now, but yeah, I'm going to find the sweet spot on that. Thanks for your help on that. The other thing you guys were talking about was the free to air. Free to air, you never paid for any TV reception. Well, yeah, I'm from the old school too. I'm the same way. You know, if it's free, then it's free. Don't start changing the rules now and we got to go pay because it's satellite. Well, there's ways around that too. I don't know if you guys are familiar with it, but I'm also free to air with the satellites. There's ways to do that with the bin files you get right off the internet.
I might have your call letters wrong, Gary. Is it Kilo Bravo 2 Juliet X-ray November? Or is it Mike?
Mike.
There's the problem. Okay. I was finding a non-existent person. Yep. I know what you mean by free-to-air and old-fashioned television receive-only terminal. I've got one of those mounted at the 70-foot level of a tower. Just got to restore the preamplifier on it. Boy, do I have things to fix around here. But slowly, step by step. Okay, let us know how that project goes, Gary. I think you're on your way. Sounds like you're getting very close. And just have to persevere. I think the next person who we should have talked to earlier is Joe, W-A-2-R-Y-Y. How's digital television treating you these days, Joe? You've been You've been experimenting with it now a lot sooner than the rest of us. I think you started experimenting with digital television like 3 or 4 months ago, at least, if it wasn't even longer. All of a sudden, we all got thrown